On this episode of Chicago Beer Pass, Eric Hobbs joins Nick and I to talk about his path from Goose Island to Penrose to Sallamoth and everything that they're doing currently during the stay-at-home orders. All that and more on this week's episode. Here we are, hitting up events, drinking our way through Chicago beer, and trying not to miss a thing.
Yeah, because, you know, got a cork popped out, boom, it flies like fucking 10 feet. We're like, yeah, let's do it.
You know, all you have to do is add some fruit, stir it up, and ride that milkshake wave.
Whenever I see him, I gotta take a photo with the most decorated brewer in Chicago, Jonathan Cutler.
It'll be like the stuff you hear. Every time you go to Floyd's, all the music sounds like this. Raw, raw, raw!
Sometimes you want a small beer, but really, you want a big beer.
You gotta take in all those big, aromatic hops.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend? Waiting in line for a bottle release?
Should have never been a fad. The black IPA is delicious.
Hey, and welcome to Chicago Beer Pass. I'm Brad Chmielewski.
Brad, what's up, man? I'm Nick White.
And we got special guest Eric Hobbs joining us. How's it going?
Cheers. Going well, man. Going well. Cheers. Enjoying a lovely Sunday.
Yeah, it's a nice Sunday. I was out for a run earlier. Nick's, you know, hanging out outside. You guys were outside, so, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is our first Sunday pod, if I'm not mistaken, man. This is the first.
I appreciate the flexibility. I mean, with the way things have been, I feel like, you know, Monday through Saturday are pretty much given as far as time spent on something. So I knew I'd have time where I wouldn't be like texting last minute, be like, I'm going to be 5 minutes late. So yeah, today was good.
It seems like everyone who's still working a lot. Like that's just kind of what I've been hearing from people. And it's just kind of like, it's nuts. Yeah.
We should set Eric up. Now, Eric, you're at, I want to say you're at Sallamoth now, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, what's your role over at Sallamoth right now?
So I am our chief operations officer.
Right on.
I've been there almost 4 years now, which is hard to imagine. It's been that long. But yeah, 3.5. It would have been, you know, coming up on the 4th this summer. So, yeah, I mean, a little bit of everything in a brewery that size, but primarily focusing on our day-to-day operations and oversight of like the schedule, what we make, when we make it, and where beer goes. The best way to describe it in kind of like the simplest terms is I'm kind of the beer traffic controller.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's like a bit different from where it kind of started, where it was Goose Island and you were sales, and even Penrose where you were help starting that. And that was, you were more of the sales end of that, right? And so now it's a little more, I guess. It's almost now.
It is. And when I came over to help John, from Penrose, the focus was sales totally. And it was very much, you know, get our focus on wholesale business input with retail a little bit. But over the years, I think you'd ask any salesperson, especially one that's been with a brewery for a longer period of time, when it comes to figuring out logistics and where your beer should go and when, and how to keep it fresh and how to keep inventories where they need to be, having some semblance of sales training or experience is pretty helpful, because then you understand the ebbs and flows of programming and how doing one thing might affect, you know, your day's supply and the inventory you need. And I really think that background has helped me become better at, you know, managing. Did anything come through? Because I feel like Nick's there.
just looks like I haven't moved since we started.
Yeah.
I'm like, good.
Did we just freeze? I know it's boring, Nick. Jesus Christ.
No, man, I heard everything, man. So right. what let's backtrack a little bit. What's everyone drinking right now, man?
I got from On Tour the Heads All Empty, their IPA, like a 6% IPA.
Brown.
I think I kept my can. I figured this might be a question. Yeah. I've got Section 37, the newest pills from Sallamoth Brewery. 5.5% featured hop is Saphir. So a little less spicy than years past with this one, but it's definitely a daytime go-to for me.
Nice.
Yeah. I got the Kitty Wampus brunch in my glass. On standby, I got this what is this? This is one of the third phasers. This is Devious Methods. This is a non-hazy for a change from the Phase 3 crew.
Nice, dude.
Yeah. So, all right, cool. Just wanted to get down.
Can we clarify that you are not actually driving right now and drinking? You're just chilling in the driveway, right?
I'm also driving through the streets. No, I'm not driving. Yeah. Sundays, I visit my mom. It was super loud in there. The backyard was also very loud. So this is the only place that I could do the part. So it's kind of weird, man. Too bad I don't have like a backdrop change, you know, like a graphic I could change to. Because I feel like it sounds good. You know?
I like it.
Well, that's fine. We're not doing video, or we have the video for us, so no one else can really see that. This is all for us to talk and hang out. Nice. So, man, I don't even. Yeah, let's go back to the Goose Island days. Like you were in that like wave of like a lot of people that left around the time that the buyout happened, and it just sort of like the exodus that happened then.
Yeah.
Early 2010s, right? Like 2012-ish, right? I feel like that's about right.
Yeah, I feel like I remember those dates pretty well because I actually was one of the people that went from Goose to Anheuser-Busch right after the buyout.
Okay.
Yeah, because I went to work for the regional office for AB for about a year and a half before I left to start Penrose. And I left to start Penrose, I left April 2012 because we were opening like March 2014. Now I fully intended to open much sooner, but that's just how the timing worked out. But I remember the dates more particularly just because of the way that all fell.
Now was Goose was at the beginning. I think that's when we met you, but was Goose the beginning of your beer career?
No, I actually had a couple of jobs before that. My first job out of college, literally the Monday after I graduated on Saturday, was at a Miller wholesaler down on the southwest side in Joliet. So I worked for Kozel Brothers for a couple of years. And then I went to work for Joseph Huber Brewing Company out of Wisconsin and repped the Berghoff brands around Chicagoland and then eventually kind of the state. And then went to Goose Island. So I had about 4 years of beer before I landed at Goose.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Was that going on the AB side? Was that sort of the nail in the coffin for you to like make the jump, or was it just like, was it always in the works? And
yeah,
it just
how did that come about? Yeah.
Yeah. It had nothing to do with me starting Penrose. Penrose was already, you know, well underway with Quarter and I at that point. And I actually thought the going to AB was probably a good thing. It was going to expose me to new people, new processes, new systems, a whole different level of business management, which I'd never experienced before. So arguably that was probably the most challenging work I've done in the, you know, even the year and a half I was there, because I feel like I was having to learn everything all over again and develop into kind of a role player for what their bigger system required. But I liked it, man. Everybody I worked with was ridiculously intelligent and extremely, extremely disciplined with how they do their work, because it's so much. They have so much to manage with a lot of people, yes, but everybody's workload is far greater than anything I'd ever experienced.
That Goose thing, that was like, it was basically murderer's row. Like the number of brewers and staff that went on to do their own thing is really impressive, right? Like as far in modern history, in local modern history, there's nothing quite like it. What was the relationship like with you and Quarter back in the Goose days, and how did you guys decide, hey, this is the guy I want to do something with if I leave this joint? Like how did that come about?
Well, I was always really impressed with Tom. He was such a sharp and articulate presenter. So when he did a lot of like educational stuff for us on the sales and marketing side, you know, he would be the guy that would walk you through beer sensory training and taste profile training. He did a lot of our Cicerone education stuff, and then he also, when he would go out and do a beer dinner, he was awesome. He would own the room. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't been to one of Quarter's beer dinners, I highly recommend it. He really is about as good as anybody I've seen, with really the only exception being Greg Hall. But yeah, he was awesome. So I was always impressed by how well he presented himself. But you know, I never actually really worked with him closely at Goose. It wasn't until we started at Penrose that I started working with him that I learned more of his behaviors and his habits as a and business partner. Until that's when maybe, you know, we didn't necessarily know each other as well as we thought.
Okay. And then, so there really wasn't, at that time when Penrose started, like Salamoth was there, but the suburban brewery scene wasn't what it is now. Like there's
no
ridiculous amount. So the consumer may not have, they were sort of there, but they're just, they weren't going to a lot of these places to get beer as the Chicago consumer was. So did you guys, at the time of Penrose, have a hard time like getting that consumer versus like in Chicago? Because it seemed like there was always like a try to get your beer in Chicago and then also educate the people there. And then at some point, there's less Penrose in Chicago, and now it's, you know, mostly out in the suburbs.
Yeah, you know, we had a focus everywhere, obviously thinking Chicago was going to be a big part of our drinking base. And it was in the beginning. I really can't speak to where it's at now. I would argue that I can't imagine they do a lot in Chicago just because they haven't had reps in a while. Mm-hmm. I think their focus is really more condensed now to taproom and local. But back then, our backyard market quickly embraced it. And a good majority of the accounts we were looking to be a part of or working with, they were immediately responsive and embraced us in a big way. You know, it wasn't even the account base. That was the challenge. It was getting all the people that were walking into the bars and restaurants and liquor stores that you wanted your beer at to know anything about who you are and what you stood for. So, I think, you know, if you look back to even some of our earliest bottle releases, you know, the beer nerds were aware. I mean, we had hundreds of people in line for the first few releases. And I think that, you know, slowly dwindled over the years just because it, you know, the buzz kind of faded, but for the most part, people were ready and willing for what Tom was going to put out. And, you know, people were there and people were ready for it then. So, again, I feel like it's been so long now, like 4 years. Like I really don't know how their business has evolved just cause I don't see them very often.
Uh-huh. But then Salamoth already had that big consumer base, that local Naperville base. And like, mm-hmm. I guess they had like an image and an appeal that was well known, I think. So that had to be like totally different from going, you're basically trying to get these people in Batavia to know it versus Naperville. Like everyone knows it. You guys can have a party and it's packed when you could have parties. So.
Right. You know, and it was very different cultures, no doubt. I think what I walked into though at Salamoth, you got to remember, like Salamoth started like at the sweet spot. It was the craft beer renaissance of Chicago. You really did not have to do a lot to be one of the best. And there weren't that many to compete with. And not to downplay anything John or Joe did in the early days. You know, beers were solid. Tim Marshall was a really well-respected brewer from Rock Bottom. And John and Joe had a unique idea that they wanted to bring to the world. But at the same time, size and scale was relative to what the time was then. And it's like shooting fish in a barrel, man. Like there was, you know, if you had even a modicum of coolness to your brand and your beer was good, people were all about it. And you know, I think John's desires to scale over the years were based a lot on those early days and how easy it was. And I think the scale presented its own set of challenges because fast forward to when I rolled in, they just put 30 barrel system in, had the ability to do, you know, 10,000 package barrels. And we haven't seen that since. We haven't seen that yet just because the world had evolved so quickly. So many new breweries, so many new people coming to Chicago, so many people that are, you know, craft focused, but, you know, completely brand disloyal. They're going to bounce from one new thing to the next. So, you know, we've had to be a bit more professional in how we've grown up, but I'd argue that we've done that with style and some class too. We do what we do and we stay focused on what we know how to do well.
Yeah. Is that bouncing like the non-brand loyalists? Is that a tough thing for you to understand or like get from back in the days of like Goose Island? Like people were loyal and the AB people are usually loyal and like that consumer like drinks that.
Yeah.
So is that,
well, unique? you look at what John was doing early on with Salamoth, you know, this was 2012. You know, they never made the same beer that often. It was always new, which really fit the model for where the world was going. But the problem you present yourself with at that point is, you know, if you're not building on like that one thing, like you don't make your own Daisy Cutter or your own Anti-Hero or your own Ninja versus Unicorn, you know, you're not going to give somebody something to come back to regularly. That's a hard thing to grow into with any size and scale. Because think about what the world of bigger beer is. It's flagships and consistent brand. Oh.
There you go.
That's brand recognition, and that's shelf efficiency, and that's simple names and clean labels. And these were not things that Solemn Oath was giving a shit about. So, yeah.
I'm going to sit back.
Sorry. Reposition you a little bit.
But now there are a few flagships. Like, Lou is one of the flagships, like, I always go back to and, you know, always enjoy when I have.
Our core brand has really kind of refined itself into, you know, two different IPAs and Lou. So you've got Snaggletooth Bandana, which is still one of the original brands that John had found success with, traditional West Coast IPA, Citra-driven. And then we had introduced a beer called Endall Hazy IPA 2 years ago. And that has slowly continued to creep up as one of our best-selling brands. Sabro and Sultana, little 472 in there, but that one's we've definitely refined the recipe with that one as we've gotten better at our processes with hazy beers and stuff like that. But, you know, for a value, you know, an $11 six pack of a hazy IPA, I think that's one of the best in Chicago. So we're slowly getting more and more people to think so.
Yeah. I know Nick and I talk about that price point quite a bit as he's drinking that, you know, $10 can of Phase 3, but
sometimes it's a little stressful, man. Eric, you know, while we're talking Solemn Oath, is there any truth to the, you know, before the COVID kicked off, was there any truth to you guys looking to plant a flag at like a satellite location in like Logan Square area? Like that was a huge rumor before all this kicked off.
It is. It's totally true. We are 95% of the way built out in that location too. We had people finishing our flooring there the other day. So certainly have pumped the brakes as we've reallocated our resources to our people and our healthcare first, and making sure we keep as many people employed as possible. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, yeah, we're trying to keep that thing rolling. If, you know, if this all comes to a conclusion or some sort of new normal that allows bars, yeah, we'll have a South Logan, North Humboldt tap room and to-go shop here in the very near future.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys thought about where even you think the bar scene might be in the new normal or in the like next 6-9 months?
Oof.
Is that like?
I feel like that idea changes so regularly. Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked me 3 weeks ago, I'd have been like, "Yeah, give us to maybe, you know, midsummer, and then people will be back in the bars and it'll just kind of be normal." And now, you know, even 3 weeks after that, here I am, middle of April. I'm like, man, if people are back at the bars by fall, and like in any sort of like normalcy, I'd be like, that's maybe then. But I don't even know if that's true. I feel like we might go through this whole summer with little to no social, you know, outlets like bars or restaurants, and then come fall, if what we're hearing may even be true with another spike in cases and exposures and all that stuff, and we haven't improved our ability to test everybody and know what everybody's risk and exposure is, then I wouldn't see why we wouldn't be back in this shelter in place scenario. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, you ride it out like what, a typical flu season, and go through the cold weather months, and then revisit again in the spring. We could be sitting here this time next year still wondering when bars are going to be back to normal.
Yeah, I was thinking that places with patios or even Solemn Oath, you guys have the big parking lot that you could have some sort of outdoor seating, might be what summer looks like, and going inside bars might not be the thing we're seeing.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I can hope. I can certainly hope, but I just don't. I don't know, man. It's too hard to tell. And you know, I'm a guy who's gonna listen to Pritzker and the scientists. You know, obviously we're keeping everything focused at state level because, Lord knows, federal is a goddamn chaotic. You know, I think we're all getting good information on a local level, and we have some good local leaders that are teaching, you know, telling us what we need to know on a daily basis, and we're working the best we can with what we can.
Mm-hmm. How's sales been coming? People coming in for pickup and curbside and stuff. Is that still going pretty strong? You also have delivery.
Yeah.
Non-Naperville people, right?
For some. We have three zones now. So like, I mean, I'll start with. Sales have been actually better than expected. You know, our off-premise business is up somewhere around 30% year to date, which is good. You know, we like to continue to push the off-premise world, and we've gotten a lot of new business with the addition of City Water and things like that. But that's, you know, we're a brewery that's 50% draft, 50% package. So soon as bars and restaurants closed, 50% of our sales basically get stalled. Mm-hmm. So we had to get more creative with what we were going to do in the tap room. Because again, our tap room was a big part of the business as well. And when the draft sales stopped there, we pivoted really fast to outdoor curbside contactless pickup. We had our online setup the week of the 16th of March, where you could place orders online and within 24 hours pick them up. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you placed it before 5:30 that day, you could pick it up same day. And it was, I think, a week or two after that, we introduced our first delivery days. And we've since evolved into three delivery zones, primarily out in the western burbs around the brewery. And now we're adding Chicago starting next week.
Oh, nice. Okay.
You know, Eric, we had, I think it was Bulldog on the show like a couple weeks ago. And we asked them about, you know, kegs and what do they think about like repurposing these kegs and trying to package them. And they said they weren't doing it. They had issues with the canning line wasn't built for that kind of thing. And then but I was looking at I think it was Lake Effect, and Lake Effect's like, oh yeah, we got bombers, so we just put our keg beer in bombers. What's the Solemn Oath approach on like maybe repurposing, like you said, maybe half the business is kegs. What's your approach towards repurposing those if at all?
We're not gonna take any keg beer out of kegs and put it in cans. You know, we had a really nice transition, which I think happened pretty well, where we were able to keep ourselves scaled back, staffed appropriately, and still make beer so we can still get people fresh beer. We're usually coming out with like one or two new beers a week. I don't want to take the keg beer that we have and repurpose it at all. The only thing we're doing with repurposing any keg beer is we'll take beer that's over 7% and pale, and we'll give it to distilleries to distill to turn into sanitizer, and we'll donate that. Okay. But otherwise, there's just no reason for us to. We don't keep a ton of keg inventory at the brewery. Where I'm going to be exposed is...
What's up?
Lagged out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, our wholesaler bought that inventory. That's their inventory. But, you know, I think we like to consider ourselves good partners. And at some point, we're going to have to talk to them about what are we going to do with this? Because I don't want them to just get hit with all this out of code beers either. We want to try to come up with a solution. So whether it's us taking some of the beer and swapping it with fresh stuff at some sort of reduced cost for them. What? Distillery that can do that. But, you know, I'm honestly going to cross that bridge when I get there, because I feel like as those dates start coming up, it's not going to be like all at once. We're just going to start to see some of these kegs go out of code, and then some of these kegs go out of code, and then we'll start figuring out what we need to do to help our wholesaler buddies at that time.
Yeah, that seems like a whole nother conversation that hasn't really come up. You've seen like talk about like the how the breweries are dealing with it, but then that, you know, three-tier system is just, it's not working right now. So what happens to those distributors, and is that going to still function when we come back?
You know, you say come back because we're like, well, what point? What's the tipping point? What are we looking at that's like, hey, you're over the hump, everything's back on. If bars and restaurants are open and at full capacity, maybe that's normal again. But I don't see that being like a light switch scenario. So at what point does the governor go back to the ILCC pre-COVID laws and say, I can't deliver to people's houses? What's going to trigger that? And I mean, I don't know if I could answer that question. I could tell you right now, me delivering to homes is becoming a big focus for me. And I think we're starting to develop some pretty efficient systems and efficient plans to where we can continue to add coverage the further and further we get into this thing.
Yeah, I know. I got this on-tour delivered to the house because, you know, I haven't really done any of the pickup stuff Nick has, but I've like, oh, if they can deliver to me, that's even better. It's safer. You can often tip on those apps. So I'm like, oh, okay, just come here, drop it off. They call you and you're like, hey, it's outside. They kind of hang around a little bit to make sure you pick it up. And it's like, oh, see ya.
Yeah. The only issue we had right when we were trying to make that transition, we were using two different operating systems for our retail sales and then our online sales. We were using Square for retail, which is a really comfortable way for a taproom to operate. But we're using Shopify for our online sales.
Okay.
And those two are not speaking to one another, so our inventories weren't controlled like that. So it was constantly kind of like, hey, make sure you update Shopify backend with whatever, you know, you see from Square sales, and it was just a nightmare. So we quickly switched gears and went to Square Online Sales too, and that's made everything so much simpler.
Nice.
So, I mean, I think it's what breweries are comfortable with. You know, you said on tour, you know, delivered right out of the gate. I saw a lot of breweries jump into the delivery model, and I was super stoked to see that people were pivoting so fast. But, you know, one of the reasons we didn't deliver for the first couple of weeks is we wanted to see what would happen with the local community and what does Naperville and the surrounding community do to support their local brewery. And the response was overwhelming. Everybody was so, so supportive and, yeah, and surprisingly so. So we were waiting to see if there was going to be kind of like a lull. And what we started to see with all of our back-end data and like where people are coming from and where all these orders are being placed from is it was very consolidated around the brewery. So we're like, well, man, we got a ton of bars and restaurants that sell our beer in like Geneva, St. Charles, Batavia, Glen Ellen, Wheaton, North Aurora, Elmhurst. We know we have customers over there. We should just see if they want to buy some. So we started to plug in those one specific days of the week. Hey, we're going to be in this area on this day. If your zip code is this or you live here, you know, place your order by midnight the night before and we'll get you beer direct to your home. And those days started to work out really well too. So now we're looking at, you know, static zones with, you know, zone one out west, zone two a little bit further east, and then zone three is Chicago. You know, those are going to be our static zones on the weekly basis. Now we're going to see what else we want to add in. So contactless curbside remains, and then, you know, we're going to continue to just deliver to different areas as often as we can make it worth it to make the trip.
Mm-hmm. From a business standpoint, is it as simple as, you know, we have to take some of our staff and, you know, just kind of augment, and then our staff that was at the brewery now is now in basically in field sales? Or do you have to actually like kind of add staff to get something like that done? It sounds like, you know, there's some moves there if you're starting to sell more beer via delivery than before, right?
Yeah. I mean, we certainly have had to have everybody take a step back. Immediately had to, you know, furlough a lot of people. I don't think there was a brewery I've talked to that hasn't in some capacity furloughed a good majority of their staff. But mostly because if you're an hourly employee and you're making tips, what the government is offering in assistance right now is pretty great. And that has been a very nice thing for them to be able to lean into. But from a, you know, I don't own Solemoth, but I certainly operate at a level with John where I feel a sense of ownership. I didn't love having to go through that list of, all right, well, who can do what? Yeah. Who's a brewer that I know can also package, that's also, you know, savvy enough to work up front in the tap room? And if they have to, hop in a van and go make deliveries. You know, our sales director cans beer, cleans bathrooms, you know, does some of the, you know, the day-to-day maintenance around the building. Is the group having to paint the last bit of Chicago? We'll do that. I mean, it's whoever is around. You need them to be completely utilitarian. And not everybody wanted to step up that way. Unfortunately, we had to have a few conversations with people that were, it just came off very selfish. Like, well, what's in it for me? I can do this and make this money, but, you know, I don't want to come back to work. I just want to stay at home and do nothing and do this. Government's paying me better than I could make coming back, so I'm just going to stay home. And you know what? Like, everybody's got the prerogative, man, no doubt. And it's, you can do what you want to do, but at the end of the day, the business is going to evolve. If you're a part of it, you have a much better chance of evolving with us moving forward than if you take a step back and expect that your what was normal once is going to be normal again anytime soon. Because I don't see that.
That's a good way to look at it, yeah. So, yeah, some of these people either change with us or not, yeah.
Yeah, like roll with it and step up and you know, the vast majority of Solemoth staff was immediately like, well, what do I got to do? Just let me know. And you know, it's crazy to hear it, but, you know, we call each other family and we truly act like brothers and sisters. And I would argue that some of us probably are viewed as parental figures at times. But at the same time, like people that stepped up and be like, if you can't afford to pay me, I'll still work. And you're like, man, I love you for saying that, but like, I can't ask that of you. And we haven't had anybody that's had to do that. But you know, going through the furlough process or talking to people about what we want for them or what we think we can do for them, that's tough because I can't say it with any sense of certainty. I can only say, hey, let's take this 1 month at a time. You know, we'll have this conversation now, and a month from now we'll have it again. And you know, John's been cool enough to want to protect everybody's health care. So everybody at Solemn that was on our health insurance has remained. Their families, we've absorbed all the cost of that. But just from that point, it's like, hey, month to month, how's the business? We'll reevaluate a month from now.
people working for free, that's a good thing, or it's an interesting thing, because we saw in the recession and where a lot of these breweries kind of came from was people just had a lot of time and they were willing to work for free. So I'm sure there's a lot of people who have been through this before and be like, hey, I did this before. I love this. I'm fine. Let's do it again. Or I know this leads to better things.
The only difference here, I just think, is, you know, now if we have you in our building, we expect to understand exactly how you're sheltering in place and what your standards of your lifestyle are, because I don't want any of our people that are coming to the brewery to work to be the ones that are going out and protesting shelter in place or doing anything careless that's going to expose us and our families. I mean, if I heard that about someone, that'd be their last day. I'd just be like, you know what? I can't have you putting all of us at risk because we're all trying to be so careful. Plus, we're packaging a consumable product every day. We're hypersensitive to masks and gloves and aerosols and all this stuff. We just want to make sure that we're being as safe as possible. So if you're in our building right now on our payroll, you've already had the conversation with all the other coworkers on what it is you're doing day to day to keep yourself, your family, and all of us safe. Because that's the other side of it. It's like, love to have all these volunteers to help sweep the floors and clean and stuff. But then you let them and their world into your building.
Right.
So I just don't think that's not where we want to be right now.
Yeah, one bad person, you find out, oh, this person's working at Salamoth and they were out protesting, or like, or any of these breweries, is like, that could just be so bad for the brand where the one person ruins it. Like, you don't want that.
Yeah, I think we all just need to continue to do our part and be responsible.
Totally.
So no house party, no volunteers, because they might be throwing house party.
If it's a volunteer scenario, like, what are you going to be like? You can't do this, 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 and this. Like, hey, man, I'm working for free. I can do whatever I want. We don't want that conversation.
Yeah. You guys were, I want to say, one of the first local breweries to the market to kind of get busy with the seltzers, man.
We were the first local craft brewery to can seltzer. Yeah. Which, say what you want. I mean, I know I've had a million conversations about it, and oftentimes folks are pretty critical about it as like, you know, you jumped into this and you guys are just acting like a beverage company, and maybe.
I mean, you guys do sell beverages though. I mean,
like, sell beverages. Make beverages.
Yeah, I know we talked about this a bunch at Uppers and Downers for a little bit, and you said you had tasted so many of them and what you liked and what you didn't like going in. So this was sort of your, I want to say, like, baby a little bit, yeah. Right? The city.
Well, I had to champion it because I can tell you right now, like, you know, he'd have me making Belgian beers every day if he had it his way. You know, the dude's favorite beers are all, and he just loves Belgian beers. He respects the business and the nature of the business that we're in enough to want to pivot and do some cool things from time to time. But, you know, I think in true John form, you know, what John's really good at is empowering people to make good decisions on behalf of Solemn Oath. And he sits by and he lets his people do what they do. And I really felt strongly about this. And yeah, I was not a huge seltzer drinker going into this, nor am I a huge seltzer drinker now, but I also understood what I saw happening around us. And I think anytime you see what's happening and you're able to evolve in a way that feels authentically true to your brand and what you guys stand for, and you create something that is noticeably and responsibly still within the same cultural vein of what you were doing prior, you can still feel good about it. Mm-hmm. Just because we love beer and we're passionate about beer, and really cool, unique way to make seltzer. And I think we did that. I think the name's solid. I think the brand's solid. And I think the product quality is as high or higher than either of the previous. So I feel good about the time we took to do it and what we ended up with. So
how have the City Water sales been compared to the Salamo sales with the shelter in place? I often think of seltzer or any of those as like outdoor, hanging out with friends, beverage more than like, I'm going to have a beer right now at home and watch sports or watch a movie.
Yeah.
Honestly,
dude, our seltzer sales have been phenomenal. Our seltzer sales at wholesale and at Solemn Oath have been gaining steam week to week, month to month. And we came out of the gate with like a bang. You know, we fired out of the gate last November. It was like the last week or two of October we launched. And then Whole Foods jumped right away, and they soaked up pretty much all of our first runs.
Nice.
And gave us a huge feature, a huge focus. And with that, you know, when you launch with something like that, you know, the other folks take notice and they fall pretty well in line. And we had had some really good fall planning meetings with retailers like Mariano's and Jewel Osco. So they had it slotted, but they didn't have it slotted until their 2020 reset. So that was, I think Mariano started a few in January, but pretty much as of, you know, January through now, you're starting to see the major groceries pick it up too. So everything was like independently driven, getting it into all the cool spots that we knew, places we liked to work with. Mm-hmm. Biggest challenge too was getting people to try it, because it was very different than what other seltzers are tasting like. There's no sweetness, there's no sugar. It hits all the same kind of nutritional marks that you're looking for, 100 calories, 5%, gluten-free, sugar-free. But at the same time, we had this kind of craft approach where we were doing the 3% give back too. Mm-hmm. 1% revenue for the planet, 1% for the Great Lakes, and 1% for the arts. So we started teeing up these partnerships too, and that kind of led into some early media. We had a big partnership with the folks from KQX, so Q101. They were doing these the Nights They Stole Christmas, which is like a 5-night series at Aragon. We were able to jump in on that. So we had a lot of like heavy branding out of the gate, and so we hit the ground running almost at like a wind sprint level. We were 400% over production forecast when we were turning into the new year.
Okay.
So it was way higher than we had ever imagined. So now here we are, very much as a beer and a seltzer company. So I'm running two more of them on Monday. So we'll have, you know, fresh two more seltzers coming out on Monday.
And I bet was any of that seltzer getting kegged? I bet that was a lot more packaged.
All cans. Yes. 100% cans.
So yep, that had been great going into this. Like,
it was awesome. It was awesome. You know, the thing that you don't know as you're kind of going from the holidays, which is, you know, heavy, heavy alcohol consumption anyways, to January, February, March, which a lot of those months, January specifically, tends to be kind of like dry January where people don't drink. We were wondering if we were going to just see ourselves fall off a cliff. And fortunately enough, like, yes, we didn't see the same sales we were seeing in November, December, but we still saw steady rebuys from a lot of our top accounts. We're like, okay, we've already got a good foundation here. So it's been a nice addition to the mix. And I can tell you now, from a shelter in place standpoint and a to-go shop that's got some variability now, we can get seltzers out the door just as fast as we can beer. It's been awesome.
Are people buying like a couple six packs and some seltzer? Cause
usually cases, honestly, usually
at the time. Okay.
You can do a mixed case, which has all four. And that's only $30. That's pretty damn good. And then you can do a favorites case, which is two of our two top sellers. And usually that's mixed berry and Valencia orange cranberry. Those are our two top sellers. For like a week, we had lime coconut slotted in there because we were out of VOC. But that'll be back on Monday. Nice. And then, yeah, but like everybody, you could buy a full case of whatever your favorite flavor is for $30. And when you look at that in relation to what 12-pack costs are for like even White Claw and Truly, you're usually playing like $12 to $15 for those 12-packs. We're right in the ball game if you're willing to buy a case at a time.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah, because I know when I got this On Tour stuff, I also threw in, they have the Luna Bay kombucha. And I was like, well, I'll try that. Like, just toss it in there. And it's like, you got nowhere to go. You need other things to drink. I open the fridge all the time. I'm like, I want something, but I don't want that.
Yeah. And I think I'm a little worried that we're not going to get the true sense of what a summer would be like with seltzers if we don't see people going out and going to the beach and going. Right. So what people are willing to do with your seltzer. And it helps us from a plan standpoint to create experiential and things like that with what we want to kind of message to people and how you should embrace this. So we'll have to evolve with the times and come up with strategies, because the old plan's kind of out the door right now, because we don't have like to even do charity stuff, right? Because like you can't do any charity work. Like nobody's doing their benefits. Nobody's doing their fundraisers. So like our entire strategy for City Water is pretty much squashed right now. So we've got some new ideas that we're kicking around with some sponsor a case programs that we're thinking about, that, you know, people could buy a case of seltzer at a reduced rate. And then we'll take the combined purchase value and roll over like Edwards Hospital and post up with like a pickup spot for healthcare workers on their way out the door to grab a six pack to go or something.
So yeah, the model, everyone's model is like completely lost, like all sales stuff, like what you guys thought City Water was doing last year is you can't even look at that for this year, and you can probably never look at these numbers for future numbers.
No, you're right. And that's the weirdest part about this is we're all going to learn as we go and certainly evolve as we go, but we don't, I mean, looking back in hindsight to try to use what was happening 12 months ago, 12 months from now, if we are back to some sort of semblance of the old normal, then yeah, it's going to be completely wonky. Your numbers are going to be totally misleading. But then again, dude, I don't know. I like, there are a lot of lessons we're learning right now going through this time that I don't want to lose as we evolve as a business. Namely, how focused we are on the details of our costs and our spending and all of that. I feel like that's one of those things that, you know, when you're a small business, sometimes you can kind of just go so fast that you don't take the time to pay as close attention as you should to some of the more important details. And I think now we make the time to do that because you really can't afford not to. Mm-hmm. So,
well, especially because we were in basically a phase of you got to have a new can every like couple days to get this consumer interested, and you just are focused on that and you don't look at the bigger picture or where it's going. It's just like, we got to keep people in here, keep people interested. And it was starting to just feel like a grind, I think, as even a consumer, like, I can't keep up with all these releases. This is ridiculous, but yeah. I'm interested.
Yeah. Well, here we are. I mean, we still release a lot of different beers. I think we've got three releases next week, plus two seltzers, which is just the way it fell this week.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're trying to keep our inventory levels healthy enough to where we can keep ourselves stocked. I mean, we're going through beer out the door, the packaged beer to go at rates we've never seen. So it's a little harder to predict how much inventory you need ready for certain things. So we're just trying to make sure we keep as much beer coming as we can and sell it before we feel like it's past its prime.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eric, where are you from, man? Like, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Geneva, Illinois. So where I started Penrose is where I grew up. So I moved home after being in the city for almost 10 years. I still here. Same house I moved into when I moved back.
You got a very interesting career perspective. I think that was one of the cool things about when I saw this on the lineup. I'm like, yeah, this would be a good talk. But then, like, you started at Goose, and then you launched this Penrose project, and now you're at Solomoth. At what point in the Penrose project did you start to think, you know, hey, maybe a shift is in my journey is needed? Like, when did that happen, and when did the Solomoth thing start becoming a serious reality for you?
Well, you know, luckily for me, I was able to.
No, I want to hear this. No, wait, no.
Did I break again?
You're good.
Oh man. Right when I started Penrose, I announced we were opening and had turned on the hello@penrosebrewing.com email address, and the first email I had in there was from John Barley. Hey man, I live in Geneva. I'm your neighbor. I would love to get to know you. If you want to meet for a beer sometime, let's meet. I want to say within the next week we were having beers at Geneva Ale House, and you know, we became fast friends, man. I admire his perspective. I love him as a storyteller, and he's become like a brother to me. So I had that relationship kind of growing the entire time I had Penrose. But it was, you know, it was a turbulent go from the beginning with Penrose, man. We weren't open 6 months and we were doing our first major package recall. If you guys remember, we had bottles that were blown up on shelves. And mm-hmm. I mean, as a new business, that was a lot to clean up. And having lived through the Juliet days of having to clean up bottles that were blowing up on shelves, I knew how to do it. I knew how to do it quickly. And I knew how to do it quietly. So I did all those things. And we bought ourselves a second chance. Most of our retail partners, even like Jewel Osco, was willing to bring us back and like bring us onto shelves. But it was the second time that I had to go through it in 18 months where we had to do another major package recall that I was like, I was not only burned out, I was scared. I was very frightened that what I was working towards and what I had been building for years was failing. And I didn't know how to manage that frustration. So oftentimes I was very hard to work with Tom. I was very critical of him. I was harsh. I know that I came at him probably in ways that I would never do again if I ever given the second chance. I just felt like I was looking to him like, why don't you know what you're doing? How is it that we're not able to do this when you were the brewery manager at Goose Island Beer Company? How do you not know how to keep beer from re-fermenting and package? And, you know, that from that point on, I just the tension in that building was just palpable every day. It affected the relationships I had with not only the other coworkers I had, but the investment partners I had. And, you know, it came down to the point where it was like maybe like right around our 30-year anniversary, right before maybe. I can't remember exactly the date. But, you know, I had a sit down with one of our partners, and he just like basically said, "This you can't be president anymore. You don't know how to fix this. You don't know what you're doing." and a lot of other things that I wish I would have recorded, because I just want to always be able to remember that verbatim. Because it was a point in my life when I got called out for failing, and I was like, dude, I don't fail. I just don't. But I had. I'd completely failed. I'd failed as a business partner, as a business leader, and I had allowed a lot of emotional baggage to cloud my judgment and to affect my behavior. And I had to learn from that. So fortunately for me, you know, I had a good network of people. I talked to Gabriel at Half Acre right away. I'm like, hey man, what should I do? Talked to Josh Deeth at Rev, mostly because those guys had built businesses, big businesses that were successful. And both of them kind of said the same thing. He said, be very calculated with your next move, because this is what people are going to remember. Can you rally? Can you bounce back?
Yeah.
And I think partnering with John was good timing, because that was the same time his brother Joe was leaving. His brother Joe went back to California to start a modeling agency or a talent agency with some partners he had in his previous life. And it was great. Joe was the sales guy at Solemn Oath. Now I was stepping in. We had this new 30-barrel system, all this capacity to grow. Good fit. But I also knew that this was kind of like my last shot. If I didn't make this work, or I didn't develop this into something successful, I would probably even question my own talent, my own ability. And honestly, given what John gave me, dude, I feel like I had every chance in the world to succeed. And I feel like I've been able to do a lot of cool shit. And it's been a lot of fun working with John, because he had a very different perspective. I learned a lot from him as a business manager, but I also wanted to like earn my place at the table. So, you know, I busted my ass, and I feel like I've always been honest to who I am, but I learned from all the mistakes I made at Penrose. And I would argue that, yeah, I certainly have my moments where I stand firm and I might address things a bit more candidly than most, but I don't allow my frustrations or any sort of, you know, building tension to fester or build to a point where it becomes toxic. It's usually an open dialogue, and it's respectful, and it's also about making sure that we're building the best business, we're building the best team, and we're always trying to improve. Because it's rough out there, man. So many breweries doing so much, and some of the ones that are successful, you just don't know why people see them as good or better, but they just are. So yeah. You just kind of focus on what you know how to do and do your best to be successful in those areas.
Totally. Yeah.
That's dope, so, man.
Yeah. That was a long rant. Sorry about that.
No, that's good, man. I'm glad you shared that. I mean, because, yeah. Like these are three brands that we have all had on the show before. Yeah. And I don't think we've ever been in a position where we have one point of contact where we can speak to three different breweries that we actually drink. So that's cool. Like I was all in. I'm like, hey, take it. Go with it. Let's hear it. Yeah. That was cool.
I certainly would have answered. I would not have answered it the same way had you asked it probably 6 months after leaving Penrose.
Yeah.
There were some times in the early days where I was certainly like, frustrated and a bit bitter. But at the time, you know, you think about it, if you're doubling down as the guy who actually owns Penrose, which is, you know, a group of guys that have a bunch of cash, if you're trying to fix a problem, you know, you got two partners, you got two guys that you've basically invested in. You got the guy who's trying to market and sell the beer and tell the story, and you got the guy who's making the beer. If they're not getting along, I mean, the safe bet is 100% of the time, focus on the guy who's making the beer, because you always find another storyteller, a guy
right.
to market. So, you know, I feel like what I built, the design I worked out with my buddy Ian Law, and the story we told, and what we were able to do to get people's attention early on, I can feel really good about that. And we had hundreds of people in line waiting for those first bottle releases. We had all the retail set up that we needed for package if we could just get it. It's not to say that it would have sold. It's just it was there at the beginning, so I feel like at least I did step out and execute against a plan that I thought was good, just in terms of the way it evolved with sales and ownership and all that. it was good for what it was, and I'm still proud of what I built. So I love that Penrose is still around and they're still doing great things. And they're my hometown brewery still. So I have a ton of friends and family that still love to go to the tap room. My brother lives two blocks from there. You know, one of the first things he said, he's like, does this mean I can't go to the tap room? I'm like, no, dude, go to the tap room. It's two blocks away. You could stumble home. So, yeah.
And on a personal note, man, I think that project kind of expanded my understanding of the Chicagoland region. Like, I always thought, like, the Naperville was the edge for me. I never went past that. I had a beer dinner at a spot right off the train in Geneva, and it kind of expanded my scope a little bit on a personal note. So, I thought that was a cool moment for me. So.
It's way out there, dude. It's certainly a far, far distance from the city, but, you know, being that it is attached to the train, like you just said, Nick, it's accessible. You got a lot of commuters that live out here, so there's a lot of that Chicago crossover. I love that I can get on the train and be in the city in an hour, and I will certainly do that a lot more once we have that Chicago spot open and rocking.
Dude, you can drink all the way there, all the way back. Me and Brad talk about this all the time. You can drink on the platform. Like, this shit is all right, man. This shit is all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the plan or the hope, there's really, you just kind of have to follow the rules right now on where we go as, I guess, the lockdown on when this new location is going to open and what's going to happen. You guys, that's got to be weird. It's like ready. Or close to being ready, and it just has to sit there now, huh?
Well, the toughest part, and you'll see it when we get there, is we have this really cool setup where we have a very nice bar space, but we have a to-go shop that's got its own entrance. It's got a giant cooler, six doors of cold beer. Like, if that was open right now, we could pop open the, because it's got its own separate entrance and everything, we could pop it open, have curbside right there. I could run all of our Chicago right out of there. I mean, I could stock that and have a van in the city that could then rock from right there as opposed to coming from Naperville. So, you know, there would be some advantages right now, even still, which is why I think getting through the first few weeks and getting a handle on what our expenses and costs were going to be before we went back to finishing that project, it was the right thing to do. But now I've kind of leaned in with John and our board to make sure that we're allocating the resources we need to get that project finished now,
right?
Not wait till like COVID's behind us to then get back to work. I want, when COVID's behind us and we can open the doors to the bar, I want us to be able to open the doors to the bar and let people have this new space and new experience to come to for Solemn Oath, because I think the space itself is really taking shape, that it's a really authentic version of what the Solemn Oath culture is. And you know, the plan right now is to have Erin Lauder, who's been with us for 8 years, be our GM of operations down there. So she's going to be the one kind of stepping in and bringing the Solemn Oath crew to life. And we've got a new hire that we're announcing on, you know, in the coming week, actually, a dude that's been around the beer scene and, you know, the hospitality industry for a while, pretty well-respected dude coming on board here, which kind of waiting on him to tell the world that he's taking the job, but, you know, new director of marketing. So going to be excited to have him in the mix to help us get folks excited about it.
Awesome. I don't know. That's exciting. I'm excited to see that. Excited to have the beer delivered here. That's gonna be good. Next week, delivering to Chicago.
Next Wednesday we've got a route. I mean, I'll have, depending on how many deliveries we have, we said Chicago, which is obviously quite a lot of ground to cover. We figured we'd see if we get beat up with 60 orders, we'll send the van in one direction and I'll go in another direction with my car. But we'll see. Usually we're averaging 20 to 30 deliveries in any given day. Okay. Our busiest, I think, has been like just over that. But, you know, I go to the brewery first thing in the morning. I see all the deliveries. I get it organized with a pull sheet. I route the delivery, and it's usually no more than like six hours ish to make the full route from where you start to where you finish. So as long as you're not too chatty with people, but most people don't want to rap with the stranger that just delivered beer.
Yeah.
They just want to deliver their beer and walk away. So
at least the traffic is nice. There's not a lot of that.
That's been awesome. You know, one of those unexpected benefits, but yeah.
That's cool. Eric, this has been great. Thanks for joining us and chatting.
Yeah, thanks for Sunday. This is just one of those days where I was like, I know I have the time. And now I got a couple beers in me. I don't think I'm going to stop.
Just keep going. Yeah.
Keep going. I'm going to stay with the Pilsners for a minute, but who knows? I might jump into something a little heavier later.
Nice. Cool. So, website solemnoath.com. People can order beer, plan their pickups too. All that information's there.
Yep, SolemnOathBrewery.com. We actually send you right to our to-go shop. We don't even really send you like a news section anymore. It's just right to the to-go and the delivery. So, yeah, check it out. And then I don't know if anybody's following City Water on Instagram yet, but we have most of our story there too. We have Solemn Oath Brewery and City Water Seltzer, I think, is the handles for those. But, yeah, cool. Follow along. We do a lot of our updates on social media. That's just the best way to find out what's happening.
Yeah. And two new seltzers and some beer this week. So, yeah, should be a good week to order.
Yep. No, it's never a bad week to order. Yeah. By all means, please keep those orders coming.
Yeah, I'll have to place the order here after we're done and schedule it in for Wednesday. So,
right on, dudes. Combined with a couple friends, man. I mean, I keep telling people, it's a little steep, but for us to travel, we're like, yeah, let's trust that one or two people might go in on an order together too. So,
oh, that's true. Yeah. I thought about that. Nice. Cool. Well, Nick, I'm sure you're still picking up whiskey and stuff. So if people want to follow along with your whiskey hunting, where can they get you at?
Right on, man. I'm on Twitter at Nicosio.
And I'm on Twitter at Brad, you know, making some bread, doing that quarantine thing. So follow along there. And then Chicago Beer Fest, Twitter, Instagram. And we got some other interviews lined up. We got a sketchbook coming on in a couple of weeks. I think we got Brian Shimko coming along. So should be some good episodes as we're locked down. So thanks for listening.
This was really cool, Eric. I appreciate you hanging out with us, man. Much continued success, man.
Absolutely. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers, boys. Later.